Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Jonathan Linden on the show. Jonathan is a podcast producer at KVPR. Born and raised in Riverside, he's a Southern California native. His passion for public radio began at a young age when his brother would play NPR while driving him home from middle school. He earned his bachelor's degree in journalism from Biola University in 2019. Jonathan has worked at several NPR affiliates, including serving as Morning Edition host at KCLU and reporting at KAZU and KVCR. While reporting at KAZU, Jonathan covered flooding of the town of Pajaro and the first Women's U.S. Open held at Pebble Beach Golf Links. Both stories helped to contribute to 2023 Regional Edward R. Murrow Awards. When not working, Jonathan can be found walking or running with his dog or watching baseball. This conversation was recorded before the election earlier this month, which in my mind makes the conversation all that more interesting. Let's go meet Jonathan, and Baker will take us there.
Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best!
Jonathan, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Where do I like to eat? As I am new to the area, so I'm still discovering new places to check out. I just moved here in July of 2024, so just a few months now. But my favorite spots so far are more bars than actual eateries. I have really enjoyed going to Tioga and Sequoia in downtown. And I also have gone to Goldstein's in the Tower District quite a bit. In terms of food, I try to save money, so if I am getting food out and about, the Clovis Taco Bell cheesy bean and rice burritos are great.
You mentioned Goldstein's and Tioga.
Yeah.
Which vibe do you like better?
Oh my gosh. I think they're both unique in their own way. I like Goldstein's more. I think it has like a unique feel to it. Very cozy.
It's an interesting bar, right? Because it's not a bar, because it's just beer. And they also have, last time I was there, they had CBD-based drinks as well.
They do have CBD. And
which is cool.
And I've gotten to know the bartenders that are there on Tuesday night, Elijah and Abby, and they're great. So it's very like friend, like small town vibe when I go there. I try to go there on Tuesdays, and I really like that about finding those kind of like local spots where you actually get to know people. Yeah.
Yeah, because Fresno doesn't really have the kind of, they have brew pubs, but I for a while I lived in Pasadena, and in Old Town Pasadena, there's a number of like beer bars that are more like kind of Trappist style and got like long lists of beers. And I think Goldstein's might be Fresno's closest approximation to that. And so it's unique in a lot of ways. And that's what I love about it too. I love a dark bar. I'm all for like lighted beer gardens and outdoor things.
Yeah.
You just want like a dark beer bar. And that's very much the vibe you get there.
I agree.
Let's not wander too far into bars though. Let's keep a focus eye on the ball a little bit. We're going to talk about all things public radio, and I've got a kind of an array of topics, and we're going to start with kind of some background stuff for you. So what is your first memory of public radio?
My first memory of public radio is my brother playing it for me when he would drive me home from Amelia Earhart Middle School in Riverside, California, where I was born and raised, going back home. I was a transfer to that school, so it was about a 20-30 minute drive, so we had lots of time to listen. So we were always listening to All Things Considered, and I don't know, I just fell in love with public radio from that point. It's always been at the core of what I've wanted to do for a long time ever since then.
So if you were to go back and add one component to your journalism degree that would make your life easier now in terms of the work you do, what would you add?
When I tell people that I'm a journalism major, they presume that I love writing and that it's the thing I'm most passionate about. And it's not necessarily. I was a broadcasting concentration at Biola University, where I studied and graduated from. And I really wish I would have done more print journalism than I did. I was so set on wanting to do radio. I knew that's what I wanted to do, but I wish I would have pushed myself to be a little uncomfortable and explore the print world more. Because I feel like that's come to bite me a few times. Obviously, I've become very specialized in public radio, and I've get to use a lot of those skills. But I wish my print writing was a little bit better than it is. So I wish I would have pushed myself to do that more. So,
yeah, and there's a really distinct form of journalistic writing, and I feel it's been modified a little bit. But that kind of, I guess you'd call it an active voice emphasis, avoiding the passive voice at all possible.
Yeah.
Short, kind of terse verb forward sentences. And it's, I don't know if you always find that in composition courses in university. It is a tricky thing. It's almost like learning a trade in terms of learning that specific kind of journalistic writing style.
Yeah. With public radio writing, it's very short and sweet. A lot of the time, your stories are a minute to 2 minutes. So you're having to cram in as much as information as possible, maybe have two or three quotes that you're using in the story. So you have to be very concise. You don't want to use too big of words. You want to keep it very simple.
Okay. Do you think there still is value in student newspapers on college campuses, like student journalism? Do you think that is an authentic enough experience that it's transferable enough to working in the industry?
Yeah, I think so. I think any kind of journalistic experience that you can have is worthwhile. I think you got to start somewhere. And I think it's if someone's presented the opportunity to write for a school paper, whether that's in high school or in college, I think they should definitely participate. And I think that's where a lot of folks get the bug that they want to pursue it is at a college newspaper.
Gotcha. Let's jump into kind of general questions I had about trends in journalism. Do you believe that journalism has a bias towards the negative and catastrophic?
Man, I don't know if it's a bias. I think sometimes news is inherently, how did you word it again?
Negative and catastrophic. So focusing, we hear this all the time. There's an emphasis on when things are falling apart, but as things get put back together, there's not, the reporters aren't at this covering the reconstruction, just the deconstruction.
Yeah, I guess that argument can be made. I think at this position with KVPR, I'm a producer, but I've been a reporter at two other stations, one in Monterey area and one in San Bernardino. And the few times that I was featured nationally were for very sad things and police shooting or natural disasters. So I think, unfortunately, part of the news is negative. That's just inherently, it tends to be sad things, but it's not necessarily all negative. I think, obviously, I'm biased. I'm a big public radio guy, and I would like to think that we take a different approach than what you would typically see. If you were to watch television news, there's a good chance you're going to see a lot of stories about crashes, killings, shootings, and things like that. If you were to turn into a broadcast at KVPR or a lot of public radio stations, you aren't going to hear about those one-off shootings and things like that. And it's not that those things are important, but we're trying to think about what adds value to the listeners and just because there's particular shootings or things, it doesn't mean it's fitting into some kind of actual increase in crime and things like that. What I tell people is particularly different with public radios. Yeah, we're not going to cover those specific shootings or crashes, but if there is a overarching trend, if there's a large decrease or increase in crime, or if there is a large increase in crime, or if there is a large increase in crashes, we will report on those things if it is significant. But we aren't necessarily going to do all those shootings and things like that, because I don't know if it always is necessarily beneficial to the listener and the audience. But I don't know if I can fully answer that question. I think it's not something I have particularly thought super deeply about, but I think journalism definitely, I can be sad and negative. I have a sister-in-law who doesn't like watching any news or things like that because it is a little too negative for her taste. But I think not all news is necessarily that. You can report on bad things, but also on good things or neutral things. And I think if you were to listen to my podcast that I helped produce, Central Valley Daily, I think you would see that we do cover very serious issues. We just recently covered the bird flu outbreak in cows, but we're also covering the Philippine Day in Delano. So I know from my side of things of choosing stories, we try to get a wide array of, yes, some things will be sad, but also fun things as well.
Okay. Do you think people process information differently, and specifically news, when it's read to them, which is what public radio is reading the news in some ways, versus actually reading it, whether it's on a screen or a physical copy of a newspaper?
They definitely process things differently. I think I even catch myself, if you're listening to radio, you're not necessarily hearing all, sometimes you can trance out for a little bit and then you'll go back into a story. I think you don't want to make things too complicated in a lot of reporting because people aren't fully always completely tuned in to a story. Unlike reading when it's right in front of your face, some people are doing different activities while they're listening to the radio, whether that be driving or they're cooking or doing something at their home while they're listening to the radio. So I think they definitely do consume audio differently. I don't know if I could explain very well how it is that they consume it differently.
That makes sense. At the margins, how much improvement do you think we can expect from media literacy training? One of my favorite anecdotes is, and he just passed away, Daniel Kahneman, who did a lot of work on bias and human errors that they make, fallacies, those kinds of things. When he was asked if all his work in analyzing bias has helped improve his own ability to detect his own biases, he laughed and he said, "Oh, I'm just a human like the rest of you." And so I often wonder if, you know, what the utility and the value of media literacy training, particularly as people are getting news and information from clearly untrustworthy sources, whether it's on TikTok or whether it's a bot on Twitter that's feeding them certain things. Do you think we can actually improve people's ability to discern?
I think we can. I think it won't be easy. It's not easy. I think people need to be willing to look outside their bubbles. When you have a place like TikTok, that can be a little hard because the algorithm really gets to know you really well and it will feed you things that you want to see. But I think one of the most important things as a news consumer is to have a healthy news diet. In our newsroom here at KVPR, we have a split screen where we're playing Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, and the BBC. And I particularly look at Fox News a lot because I find it interesting what they're talking about. And I think it's important that you're not just consuming news that you may think that you'll most likely agree with, or at least the angle of that news. I think it's important for people to be receiving their news from very different news outlets, whether that be looking at Fox News, Breitbart, or other more conservative outlets, and then also looking at the other end of things, whether that be the Huffington Post, or looking at an MSNBC. So I think it's important for people to have a very diverse news diet to make sure that they're getting a well-rounded perception, to make sure that they're getting a well-rounded perspective on whatever the topic might be.
What's your favorite Fox News show?
I don't know if I have a Fox. I don't know if I have a favorite.
I'm just kidding.
I could tell you I have very particular feelings when I watch The Five in the afternoon.
You're just a regular Fox and Friends guy, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, a couple more topics on the state of news. Do you think newspapers should be including the time to read markers on the top of their stories? I have pretty mixed feelings about this. I understand it from a utility perspective. You want to give your readers a commitment indicator, how long it's going to take them to consume the story. But I think what that tends to do is people then tend to sort what they read based on the time duration it'll take to actually read it, which then further pushes people to read the most superficial coverage of stories that they can stomach. Do you think that time marker has a place, or do you think it's just a sign of the end of days in terms of people reading long form journalism?
I haven't actually thought about that, but I am constantly looking at local media. I have a tab on my Google Chrome where I have 20 plus, maybe it's 30 local news organizations that I look at every day looking for stories because I'm always looking for the next thing that we're going to talk about on our daily news podcast. And I see that a lot in a lot of print articles. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I don't necessarily use it as a guide. I'm not necessarily always reading a full story, though, because I'm looking at so much content I'm perusing. And then if I know it's a story I might be interested in, then I'm going to fully read it. I guess I'm pretty neutral. I haven't thought of it as being a bad thing. I think it's potentially a good way for someone to gauge if they have time to engage with an article. I will tell you, I do like news organizations such as CalMatters, who have started putting like these automated players that will have a voice reading you the article. I'm a very audio-based person, so it is nice being able to read an article, but also hear it at the same time. And it's like all accessible within the article itself. Really, that more news organizations are starting to do that.
There is this broad pattern and trend that we're seeing in journalism, and it has a lot to do with the economics of journalism, where the ranks of journalists are getting younger. A lot of our veteran journalists are either retiring or being forced out due to budget cuts and things like that. And so we have a new cadre of young journalists that are doing a lot of the reporting at many of our major publications. What do you think will be the effect of that on the industry in terms of the stories that are covered, but also the news organizations themselves?
Man, do you know what's interesting is here at KVPR, this is the youngest team I've ever worked on in my career so far. It's relatively young. I'm only 5 years out of college, but I have always been the youngest person in a newsroom by 10 years. I'm now 28. And there is two people younger than me. And the oldest person in our news team is only 10 years older than me. And if anything, it's actually refreshing because it's nice having a younger perspective. But I think there is a lot of value in having veterans on your team. They add a lot of insight and perspective and can maybe, you know, assist you in approaching a story in a better way. I think I was thankful. My first station that I was at, KVCR in San Bernardino, I was the only reporter. I was a contract reporter. I was getting paid per story there, actually. And I had no support. And I was just by myself, had no editor, but was thankful to get assistance from the California News Hub, which is a collaboration between all of the California public radio stations. And at the time, the leader of that group was Adrienne Hill, and she's a veteran. She's been around a long time. She was a producer for Marketplace, which is a program we run here at KVPR, and a lot of public radio stations run it at least twice in the afternoon. And she was extremely helpful. She had been in public radio 10 plus years, and she had a lot of experience. And it helped me grow a lot as a public radio reporter. So when you aren't able to have those veterans in a newsroom, it really makes it tough because you're just having to figure it out in the moment. And sometimes when I look back on my time at even KVCR, and she was able to help me, but not even all the time. I wasn't her responsibility. She was just trying to be helpful. I think I could have used more mentorship, but I didn't have any support. And I think it is troubling. And it is hard. I think the problem is, too, you get a lot of people starting in journalism, but a lot of the time it isn't paying a living wage. And I'm thankful to say that a lot of public radio stations do pay a living wage, at least here in California. But we'll continue to see that pattern if not enough money is being invested in actually building these robust newsrooms where, yes, you can have young reporters, but also make sure that you're having veteran reporters and making sure that you also have veteran reporters as well that can teach and guide these younger folks as well.
Yeah, and I think it also can affect content. If you got a bunch of young news reporters, they're not going to maybe investigate concerns around Social Security payments as much as maybe some
of those. Exactly. That's a great point.
Things. All right. We're going to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you. You tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right. So the first one is the NPR voice. Is that over or underrated at this point?
That's a tough question. The NPR.
You know what I'm referring to.
I do. This is a trick question.
You could say properly rated too. That's
properly.
Kind of,
okay. Yes.
Yeah, that's the way to pass.
I think that's a safe call here. Properly rated.
Yes. I personally, and I'll get on my soapbox, I think it's overrated in some ways because I think what it's trying to do is it's trying to be authoritative, but also gentle. And I think sometimes it can come across as condescension, and I know that's not its purpose, but I think that's something that can come across to listeners and be off-putting. And I think I've heard it has been modified a little bit. I'll regularly listen to, I'm not like a daily NPR national listener, like the national shows, you know, what, I forget what they're called, but like first
morning
up,
edition, all things
first.
Here and now.
I've noticed that they've started to do more improvisational stuff. Like an up first, I've noted there's occasionally banter that goes on as a kind of way to maybe.
They are doing more of that. I can firsthand tell you.
I think that helps for sure. All right. Next one, email newsletters. Are those over or underrated these days? Are we getting too much of them? I have hundreds in my email box. Hundreds.
Maybe you should unsubscribe to a few, but I think they're important. They're underrated. They're good to start your day off. Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. Next one, Me and Ed's Pizza.
Underrated. I've actually had Me and Ed's quite a few times, and it's been pleasantly good. I like it.
That's interesting because typically what happens, and I have a lot of transplants on this show that will tell me that they maybe didn't like it at first because it's different, or just don't like it at all because wherever they come from, whether it's New York, LA, San Francisco, it's, you know, there's quote better pizza there. And for me, it took me a while, but you're an instant convert.
I don't know if it's my favorite pizza, but I like all kinds of pizza, though. So I'm like, I always say pizza is my favorite food group. So I will eat Little Caesars pizza, no problem, too. So I'm not a very picky guy. So
I do think it deserves some kind of column on the food pyramid, if you will. Next one, Mount Rubidoux hiking trail in Riverside.
It's funny. I hadn't climbed Mount Rubidoux until exactly on my 18th birthday. I climbed it with my dad. Underrated. It might be a little overrated in some Riverside circles, but I think more people should do it. It's a great view of downtown Riverside.
Yeah, I think there's a broader question here, which is when I lived in Southern California, I moved from Pasadena to La Vergne, and my friends in Pasadena announced publicly that I had in fact now moved to Arizona. It's like a derisive comment. And it bothered me.
Don't get me started, Jordan.
Yeah. Why don't you unleash here for a second? Because.
Okay. You are talking to a very proud Inland Empire.
Okay. Just defend the Inland Empire. Go ahead.
Okay. First off, I am very protective of Riverside. So on my car, on my Prius, I fit the NPR stereotype. I have Riverside's Rain Cross Bell on my car, as well as an Inland Empire sticker from this company called One Love IE. They're in Rancho Cucamonga Mall and the Tyler Mall in Riverside. I am very passionate. I am a very passionate defender of Riverside. I'm very proud of my Riverside roots. My parents still live there. They live 3 miles from where I was born. I was born at the Riverside Kaiser Permanente Hospital. I can tell you this passion grew from hearing derogatory comments like that from people who lived in Orange County and the LA area. I spent college at Biola University in La Mirada, which is South LA County, right on the LA Orange County border. And I also drove Lyft a lot in college and drove all over Orange County and LA. And I distinctly had multiple occasions where I would say I was from Riverside. And people would say, oh, I'm sorry. And I'm like, oh, okay.
You were ready for Fresno. Yes. were prepped for it.
What's funny is I do feel like there is a lot of similarities between Fresno and Riverside, because I had a lot of people say sorry to me when I told them I was moving to Fresno. I was spoiled. I was living close to the beach. I was living in Oxnard, California before this. And so it is different here. But I like Fresno a lot. It has a lot of similarities to Riverside. It hasn't been a culture shock to me. A few people have asked me that. I'm like, no, Fresno feels like home. I grew up around a lot of Latinos. My high school was 60%. And I love the culture here. I've been pleasantly surprised by the bar scene and restaurant scene. And I could do without the heat. I miss being closer to the ocean breeze, but I like it here a lot. And going back to Riverside, yeah, just people making derogatory comments just fueled me to feel even prouder of my roots. Riverside isn't the fanciest place, but a lot of people go there because it is more affordable. Unfortunately, that's not the case as much as it used to be. But my parents moved to Riverside from Orange County in the 80s because it was more affordable. And I think there's just a lot of good working class, normal people out there in Riverside and in the Inland Empire. in general. And yeah, I'm proud to call it my home.
I loved that grand defense of the Inland Empire. Put that out as a manifesto. All
yes,
right.
Yeah.
Next one. We got a few more. The show Parks and Rec.
Oh my gosh. That is my favorite show, Jordan. I don't know.
It's your favorite. It's underrated, right?
Oh, sorry. Yes, it is underrated. My favorite episode, season 4, episode 4, the Treat Yourself episode.
Yes. Yes. There's I think the indicator of a show is quality of a show, because television, unlike movies, is more like theater, right? Where the dialogue is the key, and a quality show has good dialogue. It's why people love The West Wing. It's why people love Succession. It's why people love The Sopranos, quality dialogue. But quotability, if you can quote it and people can that reference. And Parks and Rec is infinite quotable.
And they do it.
Even nonverbals. Like I have really bad allergies. And when I moved here, they increased substantially. And I would sneeze a lot. And there's an episode where Andy Dwyer is just sneezing and then he hits his head on the wall. And my wife is constantly making references to that.
The Hammer scene, yes.
Yeah. All right. Next one. The McDonald's Museum in San Bernardino.
Oh my gosh. Jordan, I've never been to that, but I need
to
go.
You eaten at the first McDonald's?
I've eaten at the Norwalk McDonald's, which is the oldest McDonald's still around. And okay, that one's kind of close to my college in La Mirada.
Gotcha. Next one, Twitter post Elon. I know you're active on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Elon. I don't know if I should say that. There was a big controversy. Overrated. Sorry. Yes, I forgot.
Yes.
Sorry. Overrated.
There you go. There you go.
I still use it. I've gotten more into it since I've joined KVPR, but I was not a fan of him saying that NPR was a state-funded media source, and NPR since then is not active. And I like it, though, because especially in emergency situations, it's still a great place to go for those types of things. But I would not be opposed if someone else somehow was able to take over.
Yeah, it's very much the Wild West now. I appreciate some elements of curation. And I think what bothers me the most is just there's a bunch of things that bother me. Unexpected encounters with porn, bots that are feeding you weird stuff.
Interesting ads nowadays.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch on there that it just feels, if the New York Post became a social media site or one of those like things that, you know, those like newspapers you get where you're checking out at the grocery store, if those became a news, some kind of information, I don't even know what to call it now. It's wild. All right, last one. This is not an over underrated, but just a general temperature taking. And I want to mention that we are recording this on Thursday, October 24th, the day before the World Series starts. How do you feel being a Dodgers fan in Fresno?
It's not bad. I see quite a bit of Dodger fans. I'm used to being in enemy territory in the past. I've been used to being in enemy territory in the past. I've lived in the Bay Area, the Monterey Bay Area as well. And I was used to being around Giants fans and things like that. It feels like a friendly, safe space here in Fresno.
Yeah, it is a kind of divided city. Dodgers fans are definitely a minority, but it's tolerant in the ways where it's not in the Bay Area. There is a high amount of Dodger intolerance in the Bay Area, which is, some of it's deserved. Dodgers fans are not the most peaceful people, but
don't be an opposing fan and sit in the left field pavilion. That's just my warning. Okay. At Dodger Stadium. That's my one warning.
All right. Let's jump to NPR specifically, because there's a number to talk about. And I want to start by talking about the state of NPR. There's been a number of challenges that NPR has faced over the past few years. We know about those, which is declining listenership, corporate advertising is down. That's not specific to NPR, but specific to the journalism industry in general. There's difficulties in terms of attracting diverse audiences, other challenges. Some of these are specific to NPR and some of them are just, here's a quotation from a New York Times article I read about what's been going on. It's from, the man being quoted here is Eric Newsom, who is a former NPR executive. And he said, "I believe that public radio has 5 to 7 years to reimagine itself before it's simply unsustainable." And then he continues and says, "And they can't take 2 or 3 years of that time debating a business model." What he's referencing is just this, there's a pivot coming. And we can see early signs of what that pivot is. What would you like that pivot to be?
That is the question, Jordan.
Yeah, I want to hear your perspective.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if I have the answers for it, and I'm glad I don't have to make those decisions, but obviously something needs to change. The typical NPR audience member is in their 50s and 60s, if not older. And yeah, if they want to continue to be around, that needs to change. Most people my age in their 20s do not listen to public radio. If they do discover it and actually check it out, I think some people actually genuinely like it because it is good programming for the most part. But in terms of change, I don't know what that looks like. I think NPR is definitely trying to do more pop culture things on their morning show, Morning Edition. Same thing with All Things Considered, ATC, as we say.
I've listened to Pop Culture Happy Hour for years. And I don't know if it's subject matter or if it's marketing or what it is, but I think a lot of the content is there. So I'm not sure where the barrier is personally.
And they have done a great job with NPR Music and the Tiny Desk contest of where I've mentioned to people, oh, yeah, I work for an NPR affiliate. And they'd be like, oh, I love Tiny Desk. It's funny because I'm not that into Tiny Desk. Like, they've had great musicians on there, but that's not the biggest thing I'm crazy about with NPR. But like, that has really reached a big audience, and it's been a great way to reach out to people. But I don't know if all those views are necessarily translating the people that are listening to their other programming, though. So that might be a potential issue.
Do you think, and I was talking to someone else that works in media about this recently, and they were mentioning this kind of opacity between objective, quasi-neutral based coverage or reporting, and then editorial, and how sometimes with NPR, it can be hard to draw lines necessarily, sometimes where you feel like you're not sure because things aren't, it's fluid, right? And so I guess I don't know if that is a component of it. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting to me hear from a lot of more conservative, right-leaning people that NPR is very liberal, too democratic. And then I'll see on the same, and then I'll see from very progressive people that NPR is too neutral and in the middle and too much about hearing both sides. I don't think I got lost there with your one question, but
I got lost with my question too. Really, I'm just hearing and referencing things I see and trying to figure out what is it? Because I do think you're right. Maybe it's partly that people struggle to place it in some ways. I've also gotten feedback personally for my own programming where I'm not progressive enough or I'm not conservative enough. And I'm like, that makes sense because that's me. Yeah, I think that there is some kind of shift coming, and I don't know what that looks like necessarily, but I think it's something we should all be watching. Let's jump into Central Valley Daily. And I want to start by talking about podcasts. And I'm going to give you how I view the podcast universe right now. And then I'm curious about how you view it. I view the podcast universe as like existing within four quadrants. And there's a spectrum, and it's hard to do this over audio, but I'm going to attempt to. So I think that there are two measurements for podcasts, quality of production and quality of content. And you have many podcasts that are low quality of content, low quality of production. These are, you're in your living room, you're recording with your buddies as you draft your fantasy football team. No one really cares about your fantasy football choices, and you're doing it on voice memos on your iPhone, and you're throwing it up on the internet, and four people listen on YouTube, but you're happy you did it because you connected with your friends and it's great. There's a lot of those. Then you have high production, low quality, which I would categorize as the YouTube podcast where you have celebrities or influencers talking about their sex lives or something random. And it's the questions are dumbed down, but it's beautiful. It's highly clickable. It's revenue generating. And then you have high content, high value content, and then low quality production. I listen to a lot of university professors that run their own podcasts that are incredibly intelligent people producing high quality stuff, but they're in their office at their university recording it, and the sound quality is not great. They clipped some garage band loop as their introduction music or whatever. And then you have the final quadrant, which is high content quality, high production quality. And that's a synonym for money, which is you have a production team, you've got an editorial team, you're trying to push out the highest quality content with the highest quality production. So everything from Apple podcasts to New York Times podcasts and those kinds of things. And so that's how I tend to view the podcast universe. How do you view it?
I don't know if I've thought as deeply about it, Jordan. I think you have some great points there. I think what's nice about podcasting is that there's kind of space for everyone and that you have the full spectrum of quality and whether when I don't know if I definitely haven't thought about it as deeply as you, but I can tell you that you were talking about celebrity podcasts. And I don't know, being an audio guy, I hear a lot of being an audio guy. I'm very in tune to audio quality with a lot of these podcasts. And it blows my mind how bad the audio quality is with some of these higher celebrities where it's like the volume's not matching or their mics are peaking and it drives me nuts.
Yeah. You know, one of these ones I was talking about, low production quality, but high quality content. There's the kind of the guy that invented political blogging. His name is Andrew Sullivan. When I was in college in the mid 2000s, in that Obama moment, he was kind of the lead blogger. He had a blog called The Daily Dish. Anyway, he has a podcast now, the something Dish is in the name. And he has tens, 20s, 30, 50,000 subscribers to this podcast. Wow. And the volume is so low that I have to jack up my headphones almost to peak to hear him sometimes. And I'm sitting here going, how does this happen? How do you have an enormous audience and your production quality is terrible? Anyway,
about match loudness and loofs. That's what he
Okay, let's jump into Central Valley Daily. Why a daily podcast? That's an incredible amount of work.
It is an incredible amount of work. I don't know if I have a good reason as to why that was. My position is funded by the Central Valley Journalism Collaborative, and I think the station really wanted to broaden its reach. And I think this is part of us trying to get in tuned with a more younger audience, is creating a different way for them to listen.
Yeah, and I asked that question because the predecessor, there's a number of predecessor programs.
Valley Edition here.
Valley Edition was more of a weekly show. It is a pivot. And so I was curious if there was a specific reason for that.
I think daily, it is definitely a lot of work. I am more than 8 hours after I started my day during the recording of this show, during the recording of this interview. And I still have to finish editing an interview that I'll be putting on to our show tomorrow morning during my 6 a.m. edit. It's a lot. But I think it's a way to serve our community. I think there definitely have been a lot of questions about the frequency of the podcast when we were planning this. Could we really do 5 days a week? Because it is a lot, but it is definitely a team effort here. The first 3-4 minutes of the show is mostly from our news department itself. They're putting together a newscast and stuff. And then the long feature interview has my hands all over it, where I'm starting, where I'm booking the guest and doing all the other things in between. And Elizabeth Arkalian, our host, helps write the questions a lot of the time. But I think it's an effective way to serve the community, because I think an issue with the prior show, it was a very good program, but I don't think people were always listening for the entire hour span of the show. And I think a position of the station is this is an effective use of our resources, that we're able to repurpose a lot of our feature stories and things like that for a podcast format, and also get to explore news topics that our team otherwise wouldn't have time to cover. And we just did an interview with a Vanity Fair reporter who did some great reporting on the avian flu, who did some great reporting on the avian influenza outbreak in dairy cows, not just here in California, but across the country. And our team, Carrie Klein, Crescencio Rodriguez Delgado, and other team members have been doing some great reporting on that. But we can only do so much. We are producing daily content, and we don't have the time or resources to be able to put in as much investigative work as we would like. And so because of the podcast, we're able to reach out to this reporter, interview her about her work, and we're able to add that to the other stuff that we've already been covering with this topic as well. And so I think, we just think it's an effective way and good way to engage with our audience.
How do you think about geographical equity? And I'll explain what I mean by that. Having lived in the Central Valley for a while now, there's some areas that have a gravitational pull just because of density. Fresno, Bakersfield, some of the larger cities, Visalia. And then you have all of these outlying rural towns that just don't get as much coverage because they're smaller. There's less people that live there. How do you think about, given your coverage area, making sure that all communities are represented? And is there a specific kind of rubric that you use to think about making sure that everyone is covered equitably?
Yeah, great question, Jordan. Do you know what's funny? Just this week, Elizabeth Arkalian, our host, made a list at my request. I had asked, can you like create some kind of list where we can document, you know, all the locations that we've covered in our show so far? And so like more than half of our episodes have been about broad issues that can, you know, pertain to most people in the Central Valley, but then 9 or 10 of our episodes have been Fresno County area specific. And it is a lot to balance. We are definitely trying to make sure that we are covering everyone equally, but then we also have to consider the fact that we know for a fact here at KBPR, at least most of our audience is in the Fresno area. Most of our donors are in this area. We definitely want to give Fresno coverage and give our listeners what they want. But we also have listeners all the way up in Merced and all the way down in Bakersfield. And so we want to make sure that we're evenly covering everyone as much as possible. And so I think it's difficult because you're trying to find this fine balance of you want to cover a wide group of people, but you also want what you're putting on to be engaging for the listener. And so that's also our job as being in the podcast team to make sure that if we are presenting a topic about maybe an event happening in Hanford, we covered some stuff happening in China Alley. How do we make that applicable to a broader audience? It is definitely a lot to deal with it and try to balance, but we are doing our best. I think like one county we haven't covered, the one county we haven't covered so far is Mariposa, but I'll try to work on trying to cover it at some point. Yeah, but yeah, it is a smaller population though. So that also contributes to the lack of coverage as well.
I'm happy you haven't covered them that because that probably means there hasn't been fires. Yeah. So there's an upside to lack of coverage.
That is true.
No bad
yes.
Things going on.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Last question before we get to books. I ask everybody how their particular profession and expertise affects the way they view a city and specifically Fresno. And I know you're relatively new to the area, but you've been producing a podcast about the area. Yeah. It's covered a lot of topics. How does what you do as a reporter affect the way Fresno or cities in general?
Let me think about this. How does it affect how I feel?
How you view the city. And
how
view
do
cities.
I view the city?
Do you want me to give you an example? The way, and typically I include this in my framing of the question. So I've worked in public education for 15 years now, and I tend to view the world through that lens, which means a lot of the problems that I tend to gravitate towards are education problems. People don't know how to access the resources that they need or the understand the system and how it works. And therefore the solutions, if you define the problems that way, are education solutions.
Yeah.
How does what you do affect the way problems and solutions and the variables at work in Fresno?
I think I've worked at a lot of stations now. This is the fourth public radio station I've been paid to work at. I've been at other stations besides that. But I think every city is unique and different. I think every city has corruption or its own drama. I'm more of, honestly, a go with the flow kind of guy. But I will say when I'm traveling around, I'm always vigilant about what will make a story. So I guess that impacts my view of the world. I'm like, I'm always low key thinking of, oh, that would make an interesting story of, oh, I see that sign. I should look into that. That might make an interesting podcast episode. So then I'm producing a 5-day-a-week podcast. And just in general, even before when I was a reporter, you're always on your toes looking for the next thing to talk about, for the next thing to cover. And so I don't know if it morphs your worldview. I don't know if it does for me.
We're going to close with book recommendations, which is my favorite part of the show as a librarian. I love it. So what are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
Do you know what, Jordan? I don't read as much as I would like to, but I am biased. Most of the time, a lot of the reading that I end up doing is news articles just because of the nature.
What's up? Maybe a news publication that maybe people don't read enough of that they should? Either locally or nationally?
Nationally. I think one news source that I really like, we do partner with them quite a bit. They're called Cal Matters. They're a nonprofit newsroom. They do great stories about different topics across the state. They are a great resource if you're trying to learn about your state representatives. You can learn how much money they're receiving from different groups and things like that. I think they do a lot of great work there. In terms of other publications, I'm trying to think. I don't know. I can tell you.
Mention Breitbart. Do you still read?
You know, it's funny. I don't read Breitbart anymore.
Does it still exist? Does that exist?
I haven't. I think it does still exist.
I'm going to Google this right now. I just need to see. Yep. Breitbart News Network still exists.
It's still around. I used to look at them a lot on Facebook. The Facebook algorithm has changed a lot in the last 3-5 years.
But you know, when it comes to Breitbart or something like this, what I'm more curious about than anything is just the ad. So the top ad on the Breitbart website right now is intermittent fasting for seniors, which is perfect.
Core audience.
That with some Ozempic and you'll be great. Let's close by plugging your show. So the Central Valley Daily, and people can find that on all the usual podcast distributors and platforms.
Spotify, right? Apple Podcasts, the NPR app, the KVPR app, whatever app you use. Yeah.
Jonathan, thanks for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Jordan. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/FresnosBest. We'll see you next time.